Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome tonight. We are honored and privileged to have Mike Michalski back again. As some of you may recall, before I gave a lengthy introduction, which I will not repeat, but kind of left you staggered how he was ever getting any sleep. But his big accomplishment was, and this is really, I got to tell you, phenomenal, is that he had a series of successful smaller grants through the competitive process and a lot of extensive training. I mentioned every time I would call him, he was at some training or another in neuroimaging or genetics or what have you, and that has continued in his sabbatical spring this past year. And but he was successful in getting two R01s, and he talked earlier about the focus of the first one, and this gives us an early look at the progress and the questions that are being addressed in the second R01. These R01s, for those who don't know, they're the heavy-duty lifters of NIH and NIMH grant funding. They can be for up to $500,000 a year ordinarily, more with agreement of the institute, and some do, and for up to 5 years, and then can be renewed for periods. So they are the top of the heap, and it is just phenomenal to get two of these really at the same time, which is just puts Mike in a very, very special category. Some of you were very nice to send in questions before the talk, looking at the PowerPoint, and some of the questions grouped together, particularly a number concerned the medication choice. So to help us get through the good questions that you came up, I have forwarded those questions to Michael ahead of time when we were talking about it and some of the other aspects. But if you have questions, pop them up. Earlier is better than later. The one thing is we cannot do is to get into dealing with an individual clinical case. We just don't have the information and position and to really give a definitive answer. Last week I felt very sorry. Someone asked if their borderline member would still qualify with the DSM with the slight revisions in number 5 compared to number 4 for the diagnosis. Her impulsivity had dropped off, but everything else was high. And the answer is probably, but you really have to go through the symptom criteria very carefully. And impulsivity itself would probably not knock out of the diagnostic category, but moreover, as Leanna Clark showed in the correlation, there's a pretty robust correlation between 4 and 5 in the criteria. But to get into the clinical case, we just don't want to get into the position of someone telling a psychiatrist or psychologist, well, in the NEA BPD call, and so-and-so said this, and that should be the case, and they're going to say, what in the world do they know? Have they seen this patient? Have they done an adequate exam? So we just really have to be careful there, and I'm sorry we can't do more. Maybe we can work out a format to try to be more helpful in that, but that's why. So if you don't have and want the slides, the PowerPoint slides, send a note now to naabpd@aol.com, and Dr. Hoffman will shoot them back to you. So, I really don't allow a lot of time so we don't get squeezed, so let me stop here and turn it over to Michael, who we're just so privileged and glad to have him tonight.
Thank you so much, Jim, and it's my privilege and pleasure to be here. So what I want to do is basically talk to you about one of the studies that I'm conducting along with my research team, which includes Neil Kikaro, Mitch Berman, and a couple other individuals from University of Chicago and a couple other universities. And really what this was is a question of what is the impact of SSRIs, not only on depressive symptoms, but more specifically on self-harming behavior and ideation for individuals at high risk, specifically individuals with borderline personality disorder. So I'll talk a little bit about how we got to that question, and then I'll tell you about the study that we're conducting the process we went through for to make the design decisions that we made, and some very preliminary data. So one of the first things I want to do, and kind of go into slide two, is just kind of go over some basic terminology and definitions. For some of you, this will be review when you know it, but just so that we're all on the same page. So, you know, I'll often allude to the phrase self-harm or self-aggression. That is just a kind of a generic term for any intentional behavior that has the goal of inflicting harm on oneself that is greater than is your probability of succeeding. So that includes suicidal behavior and also non-suicidal self-injury, which we'll talk about in a second. So self-aggressive thoughts and behaviors include suicide. So suicide is completed suicide. Suicide attempts, which are engaging in potentially self-injurious behavior where there's at least some intent to die. And then also suicidal ideation, which is thoughts of engaging in behavior intended to end one's own life. Suicide intent and suicidal ideation, sometimes with suicide, is often called, would just be kind of a generic term, suicidality, you'll sometimes hear. And that kind of encompasses all of those. There's a related term that doesn't deal with suicide, but does deal with intentional self-injury, called non-suicidal self-injury. And that is when someone intentionally inflicts harm upon themselves, but with no intent to die, not even ambivalent intent to die. So I'll mention these different terms throughout the talk, but just so we're on the same page. Okay, so first, you know, the idea that self-harm is a serious public health problem. I don't think I'm going to have to convince anybody in this talk of this, but I wanted to kind of lay out some of the facts and figures. There's about 11 suicide deaths per 100,000 individuals in the U.S., and a pretty scary number of high school students in the U.S. have seriously considered attempting suicide in their past year. So almost 17% had that kind of suicidal ideation. And then 8% had some attempts. Up to 20% of individuals in the U.S. engage in not suicide attempts, but non-suicidal self-injury. And that can be things like burning yourself, cutting yourself, things of that sort. So, you know, the human cost is obvious, but also in terms of a cost to society, a financial cost, you know, just using a very conservative estimate for just lost productivity and medical treatment, for all forms of self-injury, we're in excess of $33 billion in a year. So this is a huge public health issue. Now, my study focuses on borderline personality disorder, and there's multiple reasons for that. One of them is because borderline personality disorder is probably the disorder most associated with self-harm across the spectrum of lethality. As, once again, many of you already know, borderline personality disorder refers to a constellation of symptoms and signs, but really some of the key ones are marked by an unstable self-concept and extreme affective dysregulation. The prevalence is about 2% in the community, and it can be up to 20 to 40% in inpatient and outpatient psychiatric populations. With respect to how strongly associated borderline personality disorder is with self-harm, around 70% of individuals with borderline personality engage in non-suicidal self-injury. Roughly the same percent engage in suicidal behavior, so suicide attempts. And up to 10% of individuals with borderline personality disorder will actually end their lives via suicide. So it is an extremely serious problem among individuals with borderline personality disorder. So borderline personality disorder, is also one of the disorders that is very commonly treated with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And I'll just briefly talk a little bit about what selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are. So basically, they're drugs. I mean, the first one that people remember is kind of Prozac, and there's Paxil, and now there's citalopram and escitalopram, or Selexa and Lexapro is their brand names. And what these drugs do is they increase the availability in the brain of the neurotransmitter serotonin. The way they do that is by inhibiting the neural reuptake pump, so they kind of keep it in the synapse, and that allows it to be more available to be used. That increases serotonin levels, or at least the usefulness of serotonin. So individuals with borderline personality disorder have a high degree of affect regulation and a high degree of comorbidity with major depressive disorder. For these reasons, they're treated a lot with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. In fact, according to a couple of the treatment guidelines, I think the APA, maybe the World Health Organization or the European Psychiatric Association as well, SSRIs are the first line of treatment for individuals with borderline personality disorder and either significant affect dysregulation or comorbid depression, which is quite frankly the majority of individuals with borderline personality disorder. So borderline personality disorder has a strong tie-in to self-harm, and borderline personality disorder has also had a strong relationship to prescriptions with SSRIs, meaning that if there's something about SSRIs that makes someone vulnerable to self-harm, individuals with borderline personality disorder may be particularly vulnerable. And there is some suggestion, although, as we'll talk about, it's debatable, that SSRIs may, in some cases, increase self-harming ideation or behavior. So, now, first of all, SSRIs are very commonly prescribed. Some people would argue too commonly prescribed. They're among the most commonly prescribed psychotropic medications, with up to 10% of individuals in the U.S. taking them. So that's a huge amount. Back in the, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I believe the first study was, might have been Titchener in 1990, started noticing that there was some increased suicidal preoccupation for people taking SSRIs. And this kind of caught the attention of the FDA, and there was a meta-analysis of clinical trial data, and what they showed was that there was a modest increase in suicidality for pediatric patients, so for kids and young adolescents. And based on this, the FDA implemented, I guess is the best word, a black box warning on SSRIs. So a black box warning is pretty much the most severe warning that the FDA will put on drugs. And what it basically said is that, you know, children may be at increased risk for suicidal thoughts and or behavior, children and adolescents. And then this was later extended to young adults. I can tell you that, and we'll talk about some of the other studies in a second, but this initial meta-analysis, they did a reanalysis in 2007, and this reanalysis was all the pediatric data from 1988 to 2006. So all the child, adolescent, SSRI, usually depression data. And what they found was that 4% of the kids taking SSRI showed suicidal ideation versus about 2% of the kids taking placebo. And that was statistically significant. So there was some suggestion in children there may be increased ideation. Now I'll talk to you a little bit more about the data on SSRIs and suicidality. They come from two basic types of studies. One is ecological studies, where they really look at the link between usage of a medication and rates of suicide or suicidal attempts in a large population, a city, a country. And then the other type, which we'll talk about in a second, are clinical trials, which are a little bit more controlled empirically. So the data looking at SSRIs and suicidality amongst the ecological studies really didn't strongly support the idea that SSRIs were associated with suicide. So in multiple countries, they did studies, Sweden, Hungary, Finland, there's a list on my slides, and they found, if anything, a negative relationship between the national rate of SSRI use and suicide. So suggesting that SSRIs are doing what you would hope that they would do, which is reduce the risk of suicide. Other countries found no relationship, so Italy, Iceland, England. And then there was an analysis of 27 European countries, and I've got one of the tables from that, that also showed a mild inverse relationship between SSRIs and suicide. So this data, at least from the ecological studies, doesn't really show strong support for the idea that suicide is being increased by the use of SSRIs. If anything, it suggests the opposite. However, we have to remember some things about ecological studies. One is that there's no causal relationship here, so it's not addressing that there may be other things that are happening over the course of the 10, 20 years where SSRIs are being prescribed more often, which could be responsible for the lack of an increase, or in some situations, a decrease in suicide rates, better prevention efforts, better detection, so that we could potentially even mask the effects of SSRIs, increasing suicidality, if these other things are going on at the same time. So, and I have a couple of the, just a couple of the studies briefly showing the relationship between SSRIs and suicidality. So this was one, and I'm looking at slide 8 now. Just looking at adolescent suicide rates and antidepressant prescribing in the UK, in England. And what you'll see is there's that blue bar, solid blue bar, which is suicide events, suicide or events that look like they could be suicide. And then you see the dotted red bar, and that's kind of prescription. And you see that over the course of 1993 to 2005, there was a pretty steady increase in prescription rates. And overall, you know, there was variation from year to year, but overall decrease in suicide rates. And then the next slide shows it in a different way, shows the same thing. It looked at the relationship between SSRI doses sold in 27 different countries and risk of suicide. And they did it by age. And what they showed was that, once again, all these relationships are negative, some of them significantly so, some of them not. But there's either no relationship between SSRI use and suicidality, or an inverse relationship, including here in adolescents, you know, 15 to 24, there was a significant negative relationship, suggesting that the more SSRI doses that were used, the less the suicide rate for individuals aged 15 to 24. So this is encouraging for the use of SSRIs, but once again, there's a significant limitation to this data, is that these are controlled studies, and we don't really know other things that may be going on that may increase or decrease suicide rates other than SSRIs that may be hiding actual effects. So one of the ways that you can take a look at this more empirically is a clinical trial. And obviously, before a drug can be put on the market, there has to be clinical trials. So we have all this data of clinical trials that people started to look at retrospectively, started to pull together and look at. And that data was a little bit more mixed in the sense that some studies suggest there may be a positive relationship between SSRI use and suicidality, some a negative, some no relationship. So some of the earlier studies, one of the first ones was a large FDA meta-analysis that found no difference in suicide rates between SSRIs, non-SSRI antidepressants, and placebos. So this is actual suicides. But other studies looking at suicide attempts or ideation, they found more varying results. So including, like I said, some manuscripts, showing decreased suicide attempts and ideation amongst individuals using SSRIs versus placebo, some showing no effect, and some showing increases, including, I think that the study was Bridget L., a JAMA study of 24 pediatric randomized clinical trials in the U.S. and Europe. So the clinical trials data, and the next slide, next two slides, shows a couple of the results of a couple of the studies. The first one's from Calm. And what they did is they looked at suicide rate. So once again, absolute suicide rate, not attempts, but actual suicide. And they compared individuals who were taking SSRIs, other antidepressants, and placebos. And they did this, and they didn't find any difference. So if you look at the percentage of rates, you see the placebo percentage is 0.10, other antidepressants are 0.20, and SSRIs are 0.15. But none of those were significantly different. And then if you look at it based on exposure years, so how many years they were taking this, you see that the results are even more clearly not significantly different. So there was, in terms of actual suicide, the evidence is really weak, even in the clinical trials. But in terms of suicidal ideation attempts, it's a little bit more varied. Unfortunately, and I apologize for this, the second slide was supposed to show the attempts, whether there's actually a significant difference. This is from a fairly recent study by Given and others, where they didn't find a difference between individuals treated with antidepressants, SSRIs, and individuals in the control condition. So you can see, if you look at these, you have three pairs of lines. The highest one is thoughts of death, or suicidal ideation. And you see that the control and the treated are almost the exact same slope, with the control being very slightly higher, but negligible. And ideation, the next two lines, and attempts or completions are virtually identical. So I should clarify. Thoughts of death means kind of non-specific thoughts of death versus that second pair of lines, which is actual suicidal ideation. So long story short, the data was really kind of, when it came to the retrospective clinical trials, it was unclear. Some suggested there may be, some suggested that there may not be. Now, that was for suicidal attempts and ideation. For non-suicidal self-injury, there just wasn't a whole lot done. Gunnell found that SSRIs were associated with an increased risk of self-harm, and he defined self-harm as either suicide attempts or self-injurious behavior. And some similar results were found in a New Zealand study by Dieden. So suggesting, you know, maybe for what people might consider the less severe acts of self-harm, the non-suicidal self-injury, that you're seeing more of an effect of the SSRIs possibly facilitating that versus the more severe, and at the very severe end of that, being completed suicides, with suicidal ideation attempts and attempts being somewhere in the middle. But one of the things, one of the things we did notice is that if there is an increased risk of self-harm, it really seems to occur during the first month of SSRI treatment. And that was clear even from the early case studies. When they would talk about the suicidal ideation increases, they would often say within the first couple weeks, the first month of treatment. And then there was a large case control study that had that in the first month of treatment, the odds of suicidal ideation was significantly higher compared to other depressions, but only in the first month. And this was kind of supported with some meta-analyses, once again suggesting that if there is an increase in risk for suicidality or self-harm in general, that it's likely occurring during the first couple weeks to a first month. There's also some evidence that individuals with more severe affect dysregulation or more severe serotonin deficits may be, may be more vulnerable to these potential paradoxical effects of SSRIs or self-harm. So, you know, there's been a significant data that suggests that individuals who seem to have serotonin deficits seem to have an increased risk of suicidal behavior. John Mann and his group in Columbia have done a lot of research looking at the brains of individuals who've completed suicide post-mortem and showing, you know, deficits in the serotonergic system. Emil Kikaro, who I worked with at the University of Chicago and still work with, has shown, you know, using neuropharmacological challenge studies and CSF studies, that individuals who, once again, look like they have a compromised serotonergic system are at risk of both harm towards others and increased harm towards themselves. So, also, these individuals seem to have more severe affect dysregulation deficits. And we've already talked about that in relation to borderline personality disorder. But now also kind of the idea that individuals who are more likely to engage in non-suicidal self-injury or suicidal behavior typically have stronger affect dysregulation. And that can be seen as either general emotional lability, going from sad to angry to happy, or increased anger and aggressiveness. There was a study by Keel 6 or 7 years ago. It was a really nice study showing that among depressed people, the ones who attempt suicide were best predicted by their aggressiveness. So, you know, all these things are kind of under the rubric of affect dysregulation. So you have this kind of issue where greater affect dysregulation may be associated with greater serotonin deficits, and these individuals may be more vulnerable, potentially, to any kind of paradoxical effects of SSRIs. So that's just kind of a brief overview of some of the issues that led up to our study. So our research study was, you know, they had these really good retrospective studies that they did looking at the effects of SSRIs and self-harm, but not a lot of prospective studies, not a lot of studies where it was designed specifically to do that. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to prospectively assess the impact of SSRI treatment, specifically early SSRI treatment, because that seemed to be where things were at greatest risk for increasing suicidal ideation, possibly attempts, and non-suicidal self-injury. Among 200 subjects with borderline personality disorder and depressive symptoms. And the reason we wanted depressive symptoms as well is because that's the individuals who would be treated. If they have borderline personality disorder, they would also have to show signs of affect dysregulation and or depressive symptoms. And the way we defined that in the study was they met for a current diagnosis of a depressive disorder. And that could be dysthymia, depressive disorder, NOS, major depressive disorder. And individuals aged 18 to 40. And the reason we chose that age range is because some evidence suggests that the individuals who are adolescent young adults, so 25 and younger, may be at greatest risk for any kind of self-harm facilitating effects of SSRIs. But, you know, we haven't fully looked at the data for individuals that are over 25. And so that was one concern, is to get a better sample of, you know, 18 to 40, and then we can look at 18 to 25 and then older, or just look at it in terms of a regression. As age goes up, does the risk of SSRIs increasing self-harm ideation and behavior go up? But there was also, quite frankly, a practical concern. Getting individuals 18 to 25 that meet all the other criteria for this study and getting 200 of them was virtually impossible to do. So we wanted a large enough sample that we could look at the effects as they're dependent on age, and we just wanted to get a large enough sample to get enough people that we could look at some of these questions. So the independent variable for this study was whether or not they got an SSRI. The SSRI we chose was escitalopram, and a couple of you asked really good questions about why. So let me tell you just really briefly a little bit about how we came to that decision. The first time I submitted this grant, I wanted to use paroxetine. And my logic was paroxetine, A, may be a little bit more likely to lead to some of these paradoxical effects than some of the other SSRIs. There's some data to suggest that. And B, it's one of the most prescribed medications out there. But when I got the reviews back, one of the reviewers really kind of argued that that's not the best reason to use that drug. And their argument was that paroxetine is not very specific to serotonin. So paroxetine, Paxil, it does, you know, increase bioavailability of serotonin, but it also kind of increases the bioavailability of norepinephrine. And if you're interested in understanding the relationship between the effects of SSRIs on the serotonin system and how that's affecting self-harm, really understanding that pharmacological neural mechanism, that's a problem. The other issue is if there's a possibility that Paxil is uniquely identified with increasing self-harm, then maybe you don't want that as your drug if you're really trying to understand the SSRIs as a class and their relationship to self-harm. Finally, the third argument was that, and I thought Paxil was the most prescribed, but I actually looked at old data. The reviewer astutely pointed out that Lexapro, escitalopram, at the time of this grant, I think still is, the most prescribed antidepressant. So if you're looking for something that has the most meaningful impact in terms of what people are using, that was another reason to decide to use escitalopram. So for those reasons, we decided to listen to them and to move forward and use escitalopram. Now, for this, what happens is everyone gets either the escitalopram or placebo for 8 weeks, and then they're going to get open-label escitalopram for 8 weeks. Open-label is a bit of a misnomer. It's open-label from the sense that we as the researchers knew they were going to get that. The subjects themselves didn't know they were getting escitalopram for 8 weeks, so you really should say single-blind more than open-label. So they were getting the medication. They didn't know what they were getting, but the first 8 weeks, it was either placebo or escitalopram, and then the second 8 weeks, it was always escitalopram. And I'll talk a little bit more about the logic for that when I get to the design study. And then the dependent variables, the primary dependent variables were really things relating to self-harm ideation and behavior. That was the biggest part of this study, what we really wanted to understand. So we gave self-report measures of suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, non-suicidal self-injury. We were also very interested in its the medication's effect on depressive symptoms and how those depressive symptoms may relate to increased or decreased suicidal ideation and behavior, and then associated constructs that we know in the past have been associated with self-harming behavior, such as impulsivity, aggression, general affect dysregulation. And then we also included a behavioral measure of self-harm to be able to look at, it's basically a behavioral analog to get an actual behavioral sample of self-harming before and after the treatment. Our primary hypothesis, what we really wanted to figure out, is were subjects randomized to the escitalopram condition, were they going to be less self-harming than those in the placebo condition? Because what we know about SSRIs and their effects on depression would lead you to believe that, but some of the data and some of the retrospective clinical trials suggest maybe not in all cases. So, and that led us to our secondary hypotheses. So even if overall we find that SSRIs reduce self-harming ideation and behavior, you know, maybe in a subgroup of individuals, they increase it. And we want to know who is that subgroup so that we can potentially identify them and make sure that they don't get the medication or, at the least, have them monitored more closely because we know this is more of a possibility. So one of the strongest ones based on the literature was age. So we wanted to see if age was going to moderate the relationship between escitalopram and self-harm. The other one is kind of affect dysregulation, and I don't have it here, but also serotonergic functioning. If these things are going to moderate the relationship between escitalopram and self-harm. And one of you asked a really good question about, let me see if I can scroll down to it, 5-HT transporter polymorphisms. So polymorphisms in the serotonin transporter gene have been associated with depression susceptibility and potentially associated with suicidality. And the question was, how might this influence your study? Well, one of the things that we do in this study, and I didn't highlight it too much in the talk, but just so you know, is we also do genotyping. So we're going to look at 5-HT transporter polymorphisms, specifically the short allele, because that one, there's some data to suggest that that's more associated with suicidality and self-harming behavior. And then we're going to see if using that as an indicator of the serotonergic system, if that moderates escitalopram response for individuals on self-harming behavior. So that is something that we're thinking, that we thought about, that is something that we're going to look at. So basically, the primary hypothesis is overall relationship between escitalopram and self-harm. Secondary hypothesis are what may be moderating that relationship. So the next slide, slide number 19, is the study design. So what happens is everyone comes in, and during the first visit, they get a diagnostic screen. So they fill out a bunch of self-report stuff. And we do that to make sure they actually meet the criteria for borderline personality disorder, to make sure they actually have significant depressive symptoms, to make sure they don't have things that would have excluded them from the study. So if someone was, pardon me, if someone was bipolar, we didn't include them in the study because of the effects of SSRI on individuals with bipolar disorder. If someone was psychotic, we didn't include them into the study because that's kind of a special sample that we really just want to see in a more general sample. If people were currently dependent on alcohol or other drugs, we didn't include them. Those are pretty much the only diagnostic exclusionary criteria. So after we did that, then we did what we call a one-week placebo lead-in. So we gave them medication, or we gave them pills, but for everyone, that first week, everyone gets a placebo. And the reason for the placebo lead-in is to just make sure you kind of have a baseline where they're not getting medication, so if they're reporting any very early changes in behavior, self-harming behavior, or depressive symptoms, then that suggests it's pure placebo effect. And you can kind of control for that when you actually, by the time you randomize them to the placebo or the medication. So what we would do is after that 1 week, they would get randomized to, once again, escitalopram or a placebo. The escitalopram condition, what they would get is they would get 10 milligrams for the first 2 weeks, and then it would go up to 20 milligrams for each week thereafter. So they get 10 milligrams for 2 weeks and then 20 milligrams for 6 weeks of escitalopram. The reason you do that is because when you're giving a medication, you want to kind of titrate up versus giving them a full dose. Now, you could potentially give someone just 10 milligrams of escitalopram, but in conversation with both Emil and the psychiatrist involved in the study, and in conversation with a couple of the researchers doing similar things, like Barbara Stanley, she suggested that if you want to get the effects of the medication on self-harming behavior, that you want to use a higher dose, a dose that's clinically used, but not the minimal dose. So we use 20 milligrams. Now, someone asked about the fact that SSRIs often take 6 to 8 weeks to be effective. And if that's the case, you know, won't you just be starting to get the efficacy by the time you're done with double-blind part, and that only half of the people, and that'd be the half who get the escitalopram, then randomized to it, and then they get it the additional 8 weeks in the single-blind, they're the only ones that would get the full effect. Well, one of the things that's supposed to be nice about Lexapro, escitalopram, is that this medication is supposed to get its full effect by 4 weeks. And so Lexapro is an isomer, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of it, A, because I'm not a psychopharmacologist, I'll screw it up, but Lexapro is basically like the mirror image of citalopram, Celexa. And one of the things that, it being the kind of the mirror image of the molecule supposed to do, and I'm doing this once again in very basic terms for both your benefit and mine, because this is how I think about it, is it potentially allows it to maximize the efficacy and reduce side effects. Whether that actually is true in this case is debated. There are some studies that suggest that, yes, Lexapro is more effective and has fewer side effects than Celexa, citalopram. Excuse me. There are other studies that suggest that's not true. And one of you, the one comment, someone said, you know, is this the use of escitalopram by the pharmaceutical company basically just a way to keep the patent longer? And the short answer is, I don't know. It very well may be, but there's some data, not unequivocal, but some data suggest that the escitalopram may have its effects earlier and stronger. But whether that was the primary concern of the pharmaceutical company or they just wanted to basically find a backdoor way to keep their patent for another 10 or so years, I couldn't tell you. But can I go back to the study design? So the individuals get the placebo, the escitalopram, for 8 weeks. At the end of those 8 weeks, everyone gets escitalopram. And once again, the subjects, the participants don't know this, but we do. So we're single blind. They're blind to what they're getting, but we're not. So they get it for 8 weeks. For people who were on escitalopram before, they stay at 20 milligrams. For people who were on placebo before, they get 10 milligrams for the first 2 weeks and then go up to 20 milligrams. So that's how that works. And then it goes through. Then before the randomization, and then at 8 weeks, and then at 16 weeks, they'll complete some behavioral tasks to look at things like self-harming behavior. So they do this kind of behavioral analog of self-harm where they engage in just a really simple finger response task. But on trials where they lose, they get an opportunity to give themselves a mild shock. And it can be anything from no shock at all to something that's unpleasant. And this is kind of a behavioral analog to get a sense of ability to cause themselves from self-harm. We also gave them some other measures of affect dysregulation, something called the DSAT, which is like a distress tolerance task. So we gave these behavioral tasks both before the randomization, at the end of the double-blind part of the study, and then at the end of the single-blind part of the study. And then throughout the study, we also gave them measures of depressive symptoms, self-harming ideation, and other general affect regulation self-report measures. I'll tell you about some of those in a second. Let me also talk to you about what happened at the end of the study, because I'm hoping some of you want to know, well, what happened at the end of the 16 weeks? Did you just shake their hands, tell them what medication they got, and then wish them the best? The answer is no. What happened is at the end of the 16 weeks, what we did is we explained to them that they received escitalopram for at minimum the last 8 weeks. And then we asked them if they wanted to stay on that or if they wanted to kind of move off of that. And for the 4 weeks after this trial ended, we would provide the medication to them open label while we transitioned them seeing their own doctor. If they didn't have a doctor, then what we would do is work with them to find some kind of continuing care. But for that, at least that first month at a minimum, and for a couple of people, if it took longer than a month to find them somewhere else, we made sure that we continued to provide them the medication and give them continuing care. If they didn't like the medication and then they wanted to be off it, then we titrated them off it over the course of a couple of weeks. So that's kind of how we did that. And then at the same time, also try to make sure they have continuing clinical care. So that's kind of the basic study design. Participants, we talked about that real briefly, 18 to 40, they met for borderline personality disorder. They endure significant depressive symptoms, i.e. a depressive disorder, and a depression rating score, something called the Hamilton rating scale of above 12. And they couldn't be currently taking any SSRIs, not for the past 6 months. The reason for that is one of the big issues is that when you first take the SSRIs, that its effects on self-harm are occurring. And then they couldn't take other antidepressants for the last 2 months. We kind of had less of a concern about that, so we just made the last 2 months. One of the things you should note, is that they could be receiving psychotherapy treatment. What we did is that if they were stable in treatment, and by stable I mean that they've been receiving psychotherapy for 2 or more months, or it's been more than 2 months since they received psychotherapy treatment, then they could be in the study. If they just started or just finished psychotherapy treatment, that was exclusionary because we weren't sure if whatever effects that they were showing would be due to the medication or the recent offset of whatever psychotherapy they had. But if they were stable in treatment, we were more comfortable about being able to interpret the findings as being associated to the medication. So the measures, I'll just kind of briefly go through these. The self-harming measures, the scale for suicidal ideation, something called the SASI that looked at suicide attempts and non-suicidal self-injury, the behavioral measure is something called the self-aggression paradigm. That's the one where they can shock themselves. For depression, we gave them a self-report measure each week called the Beck Depression Inventory. We also did a depression interview. That's the Hamilton rating scale for depression. We also looked specifically at hopelessness because hopelessness is supposedly associated with self-harm. We gave them the Beck Hopelessness Scale. Secondary measures we gave them were of emotion dysregulation. So the affect mobility scale, something called the difficulties in emotion regulation, a behavioral task called the PSAT. That's where you have to add two numbers together every second, but it goes too fast for you to be able to do it, and you have the option to quit anytime you want. And the idea here is that the quicker you give up and quit suggests the less ability you have to regulate the negative affect associated with the task. The Bus-Curry aggression questionnaire to look at aggressiveness, and the UPS impulsivity scale to look at general impulsivity. We also had them do something called an ecological momentary assessment. And this is where, throughout the trial, they would be called 4 times a day, just a 5-minute phone call, and they would be asked questions about their suicidal ideation and behavior, so suicide attempts, any non-suicidal self-injury they engaged in, their depressive symptoms, and any other momentary affect. So they would get a call, and did it 4 times over the course of 12, 14 hours, so every 3 hours or so, and they would just kind of press the response to questions about, since the last time we spoke to you, have you had any thoughts of wanting to kill yourself? Since the last time we spoke to you, have you done anything to intentionally hurt yourself without trying to kill yourself? So we give them that. We'd also look at other momentary affects, anxiety, frustration. There's some suggestion that for people who have increased ideation or self-harming behavior take SSRIs, what may be going on is that they have what's called this activation syndrome or akathisia, where the SSRIs are reducing some of these symptoms of depression, particularly related to the physiological symptoms of depression, but are not affecting the affective symptoms yet, particularly early in treatment. So you may have a situation where someone's feeling more energized, but they're still feeling miserable, and that this could lead to increased thoughts of suicidality and increased suicide attempts, because now they have the energy to actually act out some of these thoughts that they may have had before. So we're also looking at that. One thing I should tell you about the ecological momentary assessment is, because we're asking people questions about, have you had any thoughts of killing yourself, it would not be appropriate as a researcher, or just quite frankly as a psychologist, to not do anything about that information. So what we did was, for this phone interview that they would get, and it was computerized and automated, if they reported endorsing suicidal ideation, they would be asked to hold on, and a call would be forwarded to me. And I would get the phone call, and I would immediately talk to them about what's going on, how they're feeling, why are these things happening. So I've only received a few of those phone calls, I'm happy to say, particularly from the client's, the participant's perspective, but I have received a couple, and kind of talked to them about that, and talked to them about where they're at, and, you know, referring them to kind of immediately come in for a visit, making sure they're not at a point where they're in a crisis. So that's how we dealt with that situation. So that's the kind of the assessment part. So let me tell you what we've done in the study to date. We've had about 50 people complete the baseline. So that they came in, they did that initial assessment phase, and they got randomized. We've had a large amount of dropout. Only 25 people have completed the first part of the trial, the 8-week randomized clinical trial. So, and of those, just once again, just about even between placebo and escitalopram, a couple more placebo. Some of the issues that we think were associated with the dropout, and, you know, we don't have as much data about the people who dropped out, because typically the situation was they came in, we randomized them, and then they either just never came back and never contacted us again, no matter how many times we tried to get a hold of them, or they came in once or twice, and then we couldn't get a hold of them again. And then we would call them. We would, we'd have a number of a significant other. We could ask them to contact us. We'd also send them an email and send them a letter. But typically, of the 22 or so people that basically just dropped out, only about 5 or 6 actually kind of told us they just didn't want to do the study anymore. It's one of the frustrating things about the clinical trials. We did get a little bit of information from those people, particularly early on, and one of the issues was nothing to do with the medication, just that the assessment was very onerous. So we streamlined the assessment a little bit to make it quicker and make sure they get the medication faster. And we've noticed that the retention rate in the past year was better than the first year. In terms of the people who completed the randomized clinical trial so far, like I said, by completing, I mean that first 8 weeks where they could get either placebo or escitalopram. So for those individuals, average age was about 30. 11 of them were under 25. Mostly they were female, pretty even split between African-American and Caucasian. about a little bit less than half had a history of suicide attempts, none in the past 2 months before they were randomized. And a little bit more than half had past history of self-harming, and 5 of them had a past history of SSI in the past 2 months. And these are really small numbers, but in terms of these characteristics, there were no significant differences between people who were randomized in the escitalopram condition from the placebo condition. So, okay, so now the actual, so what happened? And I will summarize by saying, in terms of findings, we have not found much to distinguish between placebo and escitalopram at this point in time. So if you look at slide 25, you'll see the effects of SSRI on depressive symptoms. The SSRIs look like they have a very slight improvement versus nothing for placebo, but, you know, at this point, that's not even near significance. And the effect size isn't very small either. If this remains the same and we end up getting the full 200 people, it may be significant. In terms of HAM-D scores, and that's like I said, the first one was the BDI. That's what the clients draw up themselves. The second one's the Hamdi. That's the interview where we ask him questions in an interview style. That was even less strong. So virtually no difference. They both look like they're improving a little bit. The effects of SSRI and suicidal ideation, once again, they both look like they're going down a little bit, but no significant difference between the two conditions. It didn't matter whether they were taking escitalopram or placebo. The effects of MSSI, well, the first one we were just using, I apologize, the scale for suicidal ideation. Then we looked at the SASI, which is a little bit more involved and looking at actual MSSI, so self-harming behavior, self-cutting and things of that sort. And what you have there is people at baseline and week 8. And you see for people in the SSRI condition, 2 were engaging in self-harm right before baseline, and then 3 were engaging in self-harm right before week 8, and the exact opposite for placebo. And this, for some reason, we don't have data from 3 people, so this is just out of 22 people. This is nowhere near significant at this point. Let's see here. And then this is SASI past 2 months. Yeah, I'm confused. I apologize here. Oh, I apologize. I knew I was going back to slide 28. I screwed up. My apologies. This was SSRI on non-suicidal self-injury ideation. So people thinking about cutting themselves or things of that sort. And those were the numbers there. In terms of actually engaging in self-harming behavior, NSSI behavior, it was the exact same pattern, whether they were SSRIs or placebos, ironically enough. So there were 2 people in each of the conditions that were engaging in NSSIs right before the treatment started, and in each condition at week 8, after the 8 weeks of SSRI or placebo, there's 1 person. So clearly no difference between the 2 conditions, SSRI versus placebo. Effects of SSRI on self-regression, so this is using that behavioral measure, and what you see is that no effect for the SSRI group, they were the same at baseline of week 8, seemed to have no impact. The placebo group actually seemed to go down a little bit, but there's not a significant interaction here. So nothing going on at this point. One of the few things that looked even modestly intriguing in terms of differences was looking at 20 shocks. So basically when they engage in this task, they have the opportunity to select what we call a 20, which is something that's higher than their pain threshold. Now, we don't actually give them that shock because that would be inappropriate, but they think they're going to get that shock. And what we found is that at baseline, for going from baseline to week 8, the individuals in the SSRI condition became more willing to select those 20 self-shocks, whereas the people in the placebo condition became somewhat less willing. And this wasn't significant, but at least the effect size was pretty good. One of the issues with this data, and this is what happens a lot of time when you have a small sample, is that the number of individuals, the average 20 shock across the 2 conditions at baseline is kind of different. So the SSRI people were less self-shocking than the placebo people at baseline. So it's a little bit hankier to really discern what this is. If you look at this as an analysis of covariance and control for that, there's still this somewhat of a difference, but we're going to need the full sample before we can tease this out. And then the stress tolerance, this was another one that was interesting. And what we saw was that the people in the SSRI condition seemed to improve. They became a little bit more tolerant of distress as a function of treatment, whereas the placebo people didn't change much. They got a little bit less tolerant. And not significant, but a little bit of something there. But once again, you also have an issue, not as badly, but whereas at baseline, the 2 groups seem a bit different to start with. So that's a lot of verbiage to say we haven't seen much of a difference in any of the self-harming or depressive variables between the 2 conditions at this stage. Once again, we only have 25 people there. One of the big things we were interested in was, what about the effects of age? And so I just did a really quick and dirty analysis of the people who were 25 and under, and there was only 4 of those in the escitalopram condition, versus the people 26 and over. And just wanted to look at if there was an effect of older versus younger in some of these findings. So, and when we did that, we don't see a whole lot. So you look at depressive symptoms, you definitely don't see a whole lot. You see the same pattern. They basically look like they're getting a little bit better, whether they're younger or older. But for some of the other things, you see some interesting stuff. So on suicidal ideation, you see that for the younger people, the suicidal ideation goes way down, whereas for the, as a function of treatment, which for the older people, 26 or older, there doesn't seem to be much of a difference. Once again, I can't emphasize enough how preliminary this is and how low the ends are, which is why I didn't even put significance levels down. But it's just something interesting to look at, because the data would suggest, if anything, it would be the opposite, is that you see SSRIs maybe increasing suicidal ideation for the younger people a little bit and decreasing it for the older. Looking at the behavioral measure of self-harm, you saw pretty much no difference. So whether they were younger or older, it didn't really affect their average self-shock. And there was also no difference younger versus older for the 20 shock. I didn't put that slide up there because you can only have so many slides showing no difference. And then look at the effects of SSRIs on distress tolerance. Remember that SSRIs seem to kind of improve distress tolerance a little bit. What it looks like is that was due to the younger people again. So that the younger individuals, after taking the FITEL plan for 8 weeks, were a little bit more tolerant to stress. They were a little bit slower to say, this sucks, I quit, I'm not doing this task anymore. Whereas the older people, and it's pretty horrible for me to be calling people 26 to 40 older, but for the older people, it doesn't look like the FITEL plan had much of an effect at all. So, just to summarize, the research is mixed on the effects of SSRI on self-harming behavior and ideation. If SSRIs do potentiate self-harm, it's most likely to occur early in treatment and among individuals who are A, younger, and B, have greater affect dysregulation / a serotonin dysregulation. So we did a short-duration randomized clinical trial to look at this, and our early findings using self-reported behavioral measures are mixed, and largely we're not finding a lot there. The larger sample and the analysis of more nuanced measures, the EMA data, which because I wasn't able to get the randomization until recently, I wasn't able to kind of pour through that. I think that is going to be very informative and better address the question, because that is going to allow us to, at very specific points in time, find out if they were having even fleeting increases in ideation to either hurt themselves or to engage in non-suicidal self-injury or to engage in suicidality. And we'll also be able to look at their depressive symptoms and some of the associated symptoms and how they have vacillated in these very short time epochs. So that's basically kind of the findings. I wish they were more exciting, but as Jim has kind of told me, it's not unusual to, during a very early analysis, not find a whole lot, but when the study's over, to find some interesting stuff. Let me just lastly kind of thank my collaborators. These are all people, Mitch, Eunice, Emil, and Jackie are all co-investigators. Emil's actually a multi-PI with me on this study. And Amy Look is a graduate student of mine who helped me pull together some of this data. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer some of the questions if you like me to.
Yes, Michael, you have lit up, and I've got some additional ones here. You are up to bearing with us for a few more minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Several people were fascinated by the data that you were, study findings that you were presenting, particularly in the early part, and wonder if there's a way with minimal burden on you of getting the references?
References for what part? I apologize.
Particularly for the first part, the suicide and so forth.
Oh, for the studies that I talked about?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I can do that.
Okay. If you could send it to us, we could post that with the tape.
I can do you one better. I'll send you the references and some of the articles.
Oh, super. Okay.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, we've got a very active, engaged audience, and they've got three challenging ones, additional ones here. They said, here's a question. Paul Soloff in Pittsburgh is looking at predictors of suicidal behavior. Mm-hmm. Did Dr. did you consider Soloff predictors in selecting your sample?
So which predictors are we talking about? Do we know? So I definitely was looking at, when I was selecting the sample, I was definitely looking at the predictors of suicidal and self-harming behavior, both from the general population and some of the measures that we included to look at. So things such as, like I said, at a genetic level, 5-HT transporter at a cognitive affective level, things such as aggressiveness, obviously past history of self-harm, which is one of the biggest predictors, measures of affect dysregulation. So I'm not sure which exact ones they're talking about from Paul.
I'm not sure either. I'm trying to fill in here in between. At one point, the experienced self-reported, he's following adults prospectively in adulthood, but the retrospective report of sexual child abuse was a strong predictor at one point.
Gotcha. So, Kimo, I feel bad because I think child sexual abuse may have been one of the, when we realized we were losing people because the assessment phase was too long, that may have been, unfortunately, one of the things that we had to kind of let go to shorten the assessment portion. So I would love, if it was up to me, I would love to have about a seven-hour battery of measures and questionnaires to give them. But this is what you, when you're doing a clinical trial, this is the push and pull of getting important and good data, but at the same time not burdening the person who's not coming in because they want to help science. I mean, they may be, but they're coming in because they want help. And not burdening them so much that they decide they just don't want to do the study. But it would be a nice thing to have. I absolutely agree.
Then the question is the work on doing neuroimaging to determine whether an SSRI, a specific SSRI, is going to work for depression with the neuroimaging being done within a week of beginning the medication, has that proved to be effective in determining whether the medication will work or not work?
Yeah, I've not read that literature extensively. The sense that I got is there's a couple things that might potentially be promising, but I don't think we're at that stage where we can basically say that this is definitively going to be an effective strategy. And that kind of actually related to a question that someone else was asking about potentially being able to just assess serotonin in terms of, like, just measure it and determine if someone actually has a deficit. And if they do, treat them with SSRIs, and if they don't treat them with SSRIs. And the answer to that is, you know, currently there is no way to directly assess actual serotonin levels in the brain. You can get proxies, and, you know, some of the best proxies are things like doing a spinal tap and getting the cerebral spinal fluid 5-HIA, which is kind of a precursor, or metabolite, excuse me, and looking at that, that's a pretty good predictor. But we're also coming up with less invasive measures to kind of get a sense of serotonin functioning. One of them is potentially neuroimaging, and, you know, there's a lot of good stuff starting to go on with neuroimaging and drug response. And another one is there's some work looking at the EEG and auditory evoked potentials and seeing if that could be a proxy of not necessarily serotonin levels, but how functional the serotonergic system is. So these are some things that we can kind of start to look at. But to kind of get back, to circle back to the question, is I don't think what the stage at this point where we can say anything definitively about that, but it's interesting stuff. So I'm encouraged by it and just kind of want to see what happens to the people doing that research.
Right. The last one, because for our audience, Michael was getting over a really severe bug, so we're doubly appreciated, and I do not want to get flack from his fine wife that we've kept him up too late.
Don't worry.
Speak to me. We have people that are very attentive, and this was news to me. I had to look it up while you were talking. On the NIMH webpage, there's an article passed, a rapid antidepressant enters clinical trials, and this is a experience of ketamine. The fast-acting antidepressant within a couple hours, it relieves the symptoms, significantly relieves symptoms of depression for a couple days, but it has some serious side effects, including substance abuse, addiction, sleeplessness.
I apologize, Jim. I didn't get the beginning of that. What is it again?
It's a variation of ketamine.
Oh, ketamine, yes.
GLYX-13 that apparently has these fast-acting effects without the serious adverse effects of ketamine. And they're just wondering whether this will change the field. I guess, this is a tough question. Might this change the treatment of depression that we're just in a whole different plateau of planet? Are we in a different place in space if this works in terms of treating depression?
So once again, I don't want to pretend that I'm an expert on ketamine because I'm not. The little bit that I've read about and understand it, there's some promising things, but I don't know enough to just speak to what its potential side effect profile is. Obviously anything that can alleviate depression and alleviate it quicker is wonderful, but you always got to kind of worry about what are the side effects, and I'm not clear about that at this stage. But these are encouraging, interesting studies, and ultimately, our job as scientists is to kind of get people to that next step where they can kind of do stuff to kind of get past what we're doing. So if they're already working on drugs that will potentially make the issue of, SSRI self-harm moot, that's wonderful. But at this stage, I don't know what the adverse risks are associated with it. My guess is it'll be another 5-10 years before we really fully understand that.
Right, and a lot of the record in the pharmaceutical area is most promising things wash out as they go through the clinical trials. So.
Yeah, and some of the ones that don't, we end up yelling at them because we find stuff out down the road that we wish they would have looked at earlier, which is kind of what happened here. So, But at the same time, when you find something that has a potential to really kind of reduce suffering, it's our obligation to follow that and to see if it really is effective. So I'm hoping it is, but I just don't know enough about it in terms of both efficacy and side effect profile to say with any real expertise.
This is the final thing. It may be kind of remote, but it's kind of, aren't our existing antidepressants like Prozac going off of patent? Out of the patent protection, is this going to change prescribing practices?
Well, the short answer is yes and no, which I always love giving because it's the awesome psychology answer. Let me relate that to the question that someone had about escitalopram versus citalopram, lexapro versus Celexa, and, isn't one basically just the same as the other? And what I found was that reading the articles is that Lexapro is actually much more often prescribed. And one of the reasons it's often prescribed is that the company is really kind of pushing it and touting how great it is. So it definitely, when something goes off-label and the pharmaceutical company doesn't own it anymore, they don't put that same level of investment, i.e. money, into kind of pushing something and touting it. So, it wasn't like they were pushing Celexa the same way because Celexa was off-label. So it will have an impact to some extent, but some people will always want the brand name versus the generic. And it's not like Paxil has gone away or some of these other drugs have gone away, but will they be marketed less intensely? Yes. Will pharmaceutical companies try to find the new best thing that they have a patent on and try to push that? Yes. That's just kind of the nature of it. One of the nice things about being a psychologist and being someone who doesn't prescribe medication is I have no dog in this fight. So I really came to this question as someone who just wanted to understand what was going on. Do the SSRIs reduce self-harming behavior and suicidal ideation behavior? Do they increase it? Neither. Is it some in one subset, some in another subset? And it's kind of nice to be able to look at it with having just, like I said, with no personal investment from the sense of, you know, I have to deal with this rep if I end up saying this thing doesn't work or causes problems. So, but to go once again, to circle back, yeah, you'll see less, you know, the pharmaceutical companies will most likely push the drug they want patents on less, spend less money and put their money towards things that they can kind of get going through the pipeline. But that also has a positive effect, is that's how we get new, better drugs.
Right. Let me conclude, Michael. Again, I don't want to keep you up here too late, is that I will just quote this for you. Great presentation. I am always combating misinformation on SSRIs. So you are having an immediate informational impact here.
Oh, happy to do it. And it's a confusing literature. I mean, because it's, you know, a little maybe here, a little maybe there, and that's one of the reasons that we were interested in doing this study. And Barbara Stanley, I don't know if she's published her results, but she did a study not too dissimilar that I'm really excited to see kind of, you know, I chatted with her about it, and I don't think she found anything overwhelming, but I'm interested in seeing kind of like how, when that all gets written up, how that shakes out. And there's also people doing things with, because someone was asking about psychotherapy versus pharmacotherapy and what's better. The short answer is, in terms of what's better, we don't really necessarily know. And they also want to know, is both better than one? And we don't fully know that answer either, but there's a study by Solar that looked at DBT plus medication versus DBT plus placebo, and that they found that the DBT plus medication, it was olanzapine, actually reduced depressed mood, reduced aggressiveness, but didn't improve over DBT alone for self-harm. Both conditions, DBT alone or DBT plus olanzapine, showed about a 50% decrease in self-harming behavior. But there's some people doing some really good stuff, Barbara Stanley, Greg Brown at Penn, with psychotherapies that are targeted specifically for suicidal non-suicidal self-injury. Tim Gratz, I believe. And then, of course, all the work from Marshall Linehan with DBT and its impact. So I think, you know, the take-home message there is, you know, if someone is hurting, you know, get them something. You know, get them involved in something, psychotherapy medication, get them connected to treatment.
Good advice. Michael, thank you so much for this intermediate progress report on a very intriguing study that's elicited a lot of interest and people have found very helpful.
No problem. I make you the same deal that I did last time. When it's done and we actually have all the data and I can give you a more full report, I'm happy to come back and do that.
Terrific, terrific. I can hear the applause going throughout the borderline world around the country and overseas.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Good night, everybody. We will be back on June 30th for a presentation about facial recognition and the response to that by borderlines versus others. And the other thing to tell you all is in July, we will have a special presentation by Bill Fleeson on his R01. Very intriguing, doing massive amounts of ecological data collection with borderlines in different settings and so forth, and this will be the first report of that very large-scale, intriguing research. And in August, thanks to Perry Hoffman making the connection, Patrick Kennedy will be joining us. So stay tuned. Everybody have a good evening and a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Good night.